Good morning, I'm Kevin Clements, Director of the Toda Peace Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome Harsh Mander, Shabnam Hashmi, Deb Roy-Chowdhury, Vino Chetty and Cullen Gonzalez, and my colleague Olivia Stokes-Dreyer to our roundtable conversation reflecting on the positive and negative consequences of India's recent election. To begin, I'd like to invite each one of you to briefly introduce yourself and your current role in Indian politics.
Hi, I'm Shabnam Hashmi. I'm a social activist based in New Delhi, India, and I work on questions of democracy, gender, and related issues.
I am Devashish Rajchoudhury, an independent journalist and writer based in Hong Kong, and I split my time between Hong Kong and India. And I recently co-authored a book titled To Kill a Democracy with Professor John Keane of Sydney University. And my recent media writings generally focus on India.
Hello, friends. My name is Harsh Mander. I work directly with communities affected by hate violence, homeless people, and other marginalized communities. I try to work as a peace and human rights worker. I also write, teach, research around these issues.
I'm Vinod Shetty, a labor lawyer working in Mumbai in India. I work mainly with informal workers and underprivileged communities, especially in one of the largest slums in Mumbai called Dharavi in Mumbai. And my work consists of human rights activities also.
I'm Cullen Gonzalez, founder of the Human Rights Law Network. I'm a lawyer practicing at Delhi.
You can see that we have around the table a wonderful collection of activists and scholars and writers, all of whom are concerned about the future of India's democracy and the ways in which all minorities can be treated equally. So over to you then, Olivia.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to just join and welcome you all to this roundtable conversation. We're really looking forward to getting your perspectives on the current situation post-election. So Harsh, we thought we'd turn to you for the first question, at least to launch it. As someone who's been working for a long, long time to promote democratic resilience in India, what were some of your major concerns leading up to and during the long election period?
I think many of us recognize that this was probably the most important election that India, the Indian people, participated in since we became a republic more than 75 years ago. The reason for this is that we have had in power a political party which ideologically was profoundly opposed to the constitutional values that that drove our freedom struggle, led by Mahatma Gandhi, and those values that were written into our constitution. But I think perhaps most significantly, the idea of the Indian nation, and I think Joe Biden somewhere said, America is the US is the only country which is an idea more than a country. I think India is an idea even more than a country. It was an idea that that it would not matter which god you worship, it would not matter what your caste, your gender, the language you speak, your wealth, you would be in every way an equal citizen in this country that we would build. The party in power actually, as I said, had a very different imagination, and we have fought for it for for the last 99 years, to be exact, since their formation in 1925. They believed in a country, in a Hindu nation, in which particularly the Muslim minority and the Christian minority were unwelcome. But if they wished to be part of this nation, they could be part of it only as second-class citizens, without equal rights. So I think this was one central idea that was written into our constitution. There was also the freedom to dissent, very importantly, the freedom of conscience, the freedom of worship. All of these were badly battered over the last 10 years under Modi. And if he was to return to power, we feared that whatever, even, you know, already effectively the constitution, in many ways, the democratic secular constitution of the country has been thrown to the winds. If they returned, were returned to power with in an emphatic way, India's survival as a secular democracy was deeply threatened. I think that's what made this election more important. It wasn't simply about electing in one party, electing out another. It was about whether India would survive as a secular democratic nation. On the other hand, you know, and just to end, it's not the political party alone. It is backed by a huge cadre, probably the largest civil sort of organization on the ground, perhaps in the world, and they have been fighting for this alternative idea of India as a Hindu supremacist nation, and battling them and battling huge oligarchic sort of accumulation of wealth by cronies of the ruling establishment. So it was the misuse of public officials, a media that has become completely subservient, not just uncritical of the government, but, you know, cheerleaders of their agenda of hate and division. So it was a very unequal battle, but it was a battle for the survival of India's secular democracy.
Thank you for that, Harsh. So the BJP didn't get the majority or the large majority that many predicted. So why do you think that happened, and what for you is its primary significance? Shabnam, you were very deeply involved in the opposition movement at that stage during the election, before and during the election. Do you want to make a comment on that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would like to say that BJP would have completely lost if they had not stolen the election. There was large-scale voter suppression across at least 60 constituencies in India. And there has been all kinds of malpractices that happened during the elections. Otherwise, the seats that we are seeing with them today, they wouldn't have got. They were not getting more than 200 seats in any case. Why this happened is, some of it already Harsh has explained, that the government which was running India and which continues to run India, Modi's government, I'm not going into the theoretical debates, but it is a fascist government. And it had totally stopped all kind of dissent. There were kind of attacks on not only on activists and writers and poets and ordinary people, but also on members of parliament, the way they were thrown out in hundreds during their time. And it had become very clear to the people of India that this is the last battle to safeguard the constitution of the country. And it was, the whole election was mainly fought on one hand on safeguarding the constitution, and on the other on all the economic fronts, because the unemployment in India has never been this huge. More than 45, in 45 years, it has been the highest unemployment in the country. There has never been the kind of strangulation of media and civil society and, you know, any kind of dissent across India. So, and also I think it's very important to understand that India is a very big and very diverse country. And its diversity is also reflected in the resistance of, the resistance is also diverse and at many, many levels. This is the first time when we saw a large scale, campaigns against this government. And it was not only the people, candidates who were fighting the government, it was just ordinary people, activists, civil society, writers, poets. Everyone had united to see to it that this government does not come back to power and at least the constitution is safeguarded. What we have achieved is that they cannot change the constitution now because they don't have those numbers. But they're still in power. They're very much in power. They're going ahead with their agenda. A big difference is that there is the kind of fear that existed in India that has evaporated. And I don't think that Modi's image can be rebuilt now. The image of development man, and that image is totally finished. I mean, or in the kind of what we are witnessing in India, the stand-up comedians, the comedy, the common people's response to what is happening in the country, that is very heartening. Although at the level of the government, things are, it is business as usual.
Mm-hmm. Are there others who have got any comments on that? Deb?
I would like to add to what Shabnam said. I would like to amplify the fact that the BJP would perhaps lost the election if we had a regular election and not what I call a despotic election. Or by despotic election, and I would like to add here that it was not just the malpractices during the election. It is also about what has been going on in this country for 10 years as it has slid towards despotism. And this was a classic despotic election that modern despotisms, as we know, do not fully dismantle democracy. They maintain its processes and structures, but capture and control them to their advantage. So in this scheme of things, a despotic election is one in which the voting is not overly rigged as in the farcical elections in Central Asia, with like 99% of voters voting for the regime. So it is not as ridiculous as that, but the playing field is tilted decisively in favor of the ruling party, so that the chances of an electoral upset is not completely eliminated, but it's sharply minimized. And that's what happened in here. If Modi did not have the kind of control he has over the bureaucracy, including the election commission, his misuse of federal probe agencies or through which he intimidated and arrested opposition leaders, had he not split opposition parties and engineered defections, had his party not cornered the bulk of the electoral funding by virtue of his untrammeled executive power, and most importantly, if he did not have the kind of control that he has over the media, then this election might have a completely different result. And so, mm-hmm. so it was not just the malpractices. There were a lot of other factors at play here. And I think India is a vast and diverse country. So it is beyond any one party or one man, one leader to completely capture and control all of its institutions. So it is not possible anyway. But Modi came close to doing the unthinkable, that he managed to capture a large part of the country's systems and governing institutions. And so the result was not, or the result of free and fair election, it was a despotic election, and I'm not surprised that he won, even though his margin fell. And secondly, I would like to add to Shabnam's reasoning for the loss, which I think was largely because it was not because people were trying to save the constitution and all of that. I think it was largely down to bread and butter issues, which she mentioned, also the unemployment. The economy is in a very bad shape. Banks are battling the worst deposit crunch in two decades. Household savings are nearly at a 47-year low. Household debts are at a record high. So people are taking huge household debts or just to consume, just to stay alive, not to buy property or anything. FDI levels are now the lowest in nearly two decades. Even local investors are not investing. So, you know, like there has been considerable propaganda to show that India is turning into an economic powerhouse under Modi. But the lived reality of a vast number of Indians is very different, and propaganda doesn't really help there. So rural distress is very real. Rural wages have not increased in real terms in 10 years. In fact, recently they have been shrinking, statistics show. The country is now more unequal than it was under the British, according to a new report compiled by PKT, among others. So it's hardly a surprise that it lost considerable vote share, particularly in its northern states where it is strong, or the northern states are more agrarian. And also there is evident fatigue over the party's relentless religion-driven mobilization. Even in major hotspots of Hindutva politics, it has lost seats. So clearly, religious politics is not a substitute for good governance. You know, like it's fine to do politics with God, but the problem with God is you cannot eat God. So, and the government in power has to feed its people. So far, people have been willing to give Modi time to prove himself, because his core messaging is that India has been mismanaged for 60 years. So how can I change things in 5 years? But now he has had two terms. So clearly a lot of people are beginning to feel that he has had enough time. And if he still hasn't managed to turn things around, then he never will. So basically, the window of opportunity that Modi had is beginning to close on him.
Thanks, good. Steph. Yeah, so I think we've probably already, in part, launched on this next question, but we're wondering whether the fact that the BJP did not do as well as they hoped, has that affected at all how they present their platform? And has it affected the whole political climate of the country at all? And Colin, we thought we'd turn this question over to you.
So I listened very carefully in the first session. At Tokyo, there was a very nice presentation made by some on how Modi might be weakened by the election. And that turned out to be correct. That prediction turned out to be correct. But to my mind, the main question ought to be, is Modi likely to hang on for the next 5 years? Notwithstanding manipulation of the elections, the despotic elections, as Dave so nicely put it. Use of money, power, political manipulation, using the administration, doing all that. The core question is he likely to carry on and sustain for 5 years? And that, to any activist in India, is the core question. Because if he carries on, as I think he might well do, notwithstanding what Dave described, the black clouds on the economy approaching us rapidly, the banks on the brink of some kind of collapse, etc. And if that coincides with an international crisis as well, notwithstanding that, if he continues, it will be a very dark time for activists in India. And all my planning for the 5 years ahead is based on that assumption. I'll, of course, be very pleasantly surprised, very happy if all my friends turn out to be correct, that they well may be. But I'm planning for a very dark time ahead, a time for increased repression, all kinds of arrests of people like us who speak out, and Harsh and everybody, and Vinod and Shabnam, who speak out relentlessly against government. So I think that is the most important thing to focus on. We know the pros and cons of what might happen and so on. We know the arguments for and against, but the most important thing is, what will we do collectively, internationally, to save our people, to save the losses, to highlight the excesses, and to bring to the notice of the world the terrible repression that might well take place over the next few years in India. That's all that I want to say.
I'd like to add, you know, when the election results came and we saw a weakened, humbled Modi returning to power, the first few days we celebrated with reason. You know, the expectation that we had, the hope we had, that, you know, after the drubbing that he had in this election, maybe he would tone down some of the most sort of worrying aspects of his regime over the last 10 years. First of all, his attack on Muslim minorities. Would the hate and discrimination led by the state and its vigilantes, would that reduce? Would dissent no longer be as dangerous as it has become? If there were different enemies, I think that the government, this government has had, India's Muslim minorities is number one, India's dissenters is number two, but also India's working poor have suffered hugely by the policies. So is life going to get better for India's working poor? And the immediate signs are very worrying. You know, sometimes a wounded animal is wild animal is more dangerous. You know, we just at a very personal level. I saw, you know, 2 days after the election results, I've been getting all kinds of, you know, summons and charges. Within 2 days, I started getting a huge number of new notices from different federal agencies. So they seemed very clear about what they wanted to do. And the first month has seen a sharp rise in lynching and hate violence against India's Muslim minorities. And both those are extremely worrying signs that a weakened Modi is not going to be a chastened Modi. He is probably going to be even more dangerous because he's assured of international support, assured of the support of big business houses, and he's assured of a continually subservient media. And he and I think that the battle to save India's democracy is, you know, the vulnerability of Mr. Modi has been exposed. And Shabnam has been talking about, I think, on social media, the kind of satire, I think, that ordinary people are sending out are good signs. But the regime is going to continue to be repressive and undemocratic and leading on hate and further fueling inequalities. I think that is also a reality.
Does anybody else want to make any comment on that question?
Can I add something here? Is that sure. The regime will actually be even more repressive possibly than before, because now, because of the election, some people have seen the election, interpreted the election as a sign of India's vibrant democracy and democratic processes. Mm-hmm. So now there is suddenly for the last 10 years, we have been hearing that India's democracy has been backsliding, but suddenly after Modi lost 63 seats, we have seen international commentary on how Indian people have spoken. I think there was one headline in The Guardian which said India pulls back from the brink and, you know, like chastened and humbled and all of that. People have spoken. So now there is an idea that actually India's democracy is all right, because, you know, the results showed that India democracy is actually working. So now there is no stopping Modi, really, because the world has decided the Indian democracy is fine.
I just want to add that, yes, things are pretty bad. They are back to business as usual, but there are many state elections which are around the corner. In October, a few states are going to elections. And in January, a few more states will go to elections. And that will also have an impact on what will happen in the coming years. I agree with Colin totally that, you know, the repression is going to increase. But in case there is a change at the level of the states, we have to keep that in mind. And that will definitely influence what happens in India in the coming years.
Thank you. You've covered some of what the next question is intended to cover, but I just wonder, Vinod, if you could sort of give us some more specific ways in which the elections really impacted India's democracy in the near term, and what are the long-term prospects now? I mean, Shabnam has already mentioned the possibility of, you know, more opposition parties winning state elections, but, you know, what are the other prospects?
Yes.
So the point is that the opposition, which thought that Modi can't be defeated and they were in a state of disarray, has suddenly found that they have made certain inroads in some states where Modi could never be defeated, like Uttar Pradesh. So this kind of unity which they found in each other's strengths, according to me, this could be some kind of a bonding effect, and this could, if they could build on this and take this to all the other states where elections are due, then we have a full-fledged fight. What is also important is the turmoil all over in the neighboring countries of India. You look at Bangladesh, which is going through you have Nepal, which just changed its government. So in terms of other countries, Modi seems to be, the Indian government seems to be very stable to the West. And given Modi's popularity with all the right-wing parties, as well as with Putin, and now he considers himself to be mature enough to go around stopping wars, he again has started building his international image. And with the kind of the elections in the US, which are all poised for his best friend to come back to power, we have a real situation here where in the country Modi is weakened, but probably internationally, because he's also the biggest buyer of oil, he may seem to get a lot of support from the international stage. And then he will build his reputation all over the world again and come back in India, showing that he has very powerful friends. All this doesn't mean that the situation inside the country is changing. As everybody, all my friends said, that you can't, this ideology of Hindutva cannot put food on people's table. So what Modi has to regularly do is give free rations. He has to give a lot of doles out there to the poor to offset the lack of employment. So this is a continuous process which he has understood, that finally you've got to put the rations into people's houses, give the underprivileged, give the marginalized sections of society some kind of income. So he's increasingly going to fund a lot of these mass popular projects where people are, you know, kind of given an opium to remain quiet and to take these doles from the government. And on the other hand, continue their breaking of opposition parties. But India has seen a lot of turmoil earlier also. There have been other governments which were equally oppressive on the people, and people have fought back. I'm fully optimistic that this government will probably see its exit within the next 5 years due to its own contradictions also, because there are a lot of small fissures and divisions coming out between the ruling elite and the Hindutva brigade, who don't like Modi's style of functioning. See, the RSS, as a parent body, doesn't like these demigods who are, you know, considering themselves above everything. So they are going to try and bring him down a peg or two and create an alternative. So this kind of contradiction within the ruling elite and majority parties is also something on which people need to build and highlight. Because the more we highlight, the more the contradictions will come out into the open. One recent issue is that Modi, for the first time after 9 to 10 years since he came to power, he has opened up the RSS as an organization in which you can be a member while being a government servant. He had not allowed this to happen. He had simply to do a small change in the notification. But he did it for the first time this time, after twice being in power for five years. So the point is, there is pressure from the RSS now that we want our people there, and we want the whole government now to be allowed to join the RSS. So we are going to see a lot of saffronization, which is going to accelerate amongst the judiciary, amongst the administration, and this kind of Hindutva becoming into a common agenda is going to increase on the other hand. So I think within all this, there is a lot of work for those who are working amongst the people to mobilize, to build movements, and people are ready to come on the streets. All that the activists and organizations, trade unions need to do is find issues on which we can unite people and build a very strong opposition. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other comments on what Vinod just said?
I just wanted to for an audience outside India, wanted to underline a little bit about the RSS and what dangers it presents. Now, the RSS is really a huge cadre-based organization, which actually promotes the ideology that we are trying to fight, which is against the constitutional idea of equal citizenship, of justice, liberty, equality, fraternity. It's opposed to these ideas. It's a massive organization, and so it's not simply about voting out a particular political party, but it's also fighting what's happening in society itself and its penetration with these politics of hate that poses a huge challenge for all of us who want to defend India's democracy. That really is the challenge that we face. You know, I'd like to underline my political perspective is the perspective of the We the People of India as written into our constitution. You know, it is in defense of those values. Let me, you know, again, for an international audience, put you into a situation where imagine if the Ku Klux Klan was a legal overground organization in the United States. That met, you know, that gathered on every public park in cities and towns across the country every morning, had parades, and they were, you know, the active support base of Donald Trump. And as Vinod just said, you now have orders saying that government officials, judges, teachers, university professors all have the right to be openly members of this organization. What would the dangers be? The dangers that Donald Trump presents to American democracy as he stands is grave enough. If he is backed by a very powerful, extensive legal militia, then what kind of dangers does he present? I think the gravity of the dangers that Mr. Modi with the RSS presents cannot be overstated. And the battle that has to be fought against it is really not simply an electoral political battle, however important that is. It is a battle in hearts and minds, because what we are seeing is the penetration, you know, this through WhatsApp, through the social media, through the kinds of speeches, hate speeches that are making. We are having a continuous dose, an injection of hate, the slow drip of hate, as part of public life, day after day after day, and to fight that is, I think, our biggest challenge. While we need to fight the electoral battle, the battle in society for reclaiming the ideas and the values of equal citizenship, of what we call fraternity, of equal rights for all, and also imagining and fighting for an economic model which where young people have a future, where they have jobs, we have an education system that works, a healthcare system at present is among the most privatized in the world. So all of those need repair, those need to be battled. The imagination of an alternative way of running the country needs to be pressed. But most of all, I think goodwill between communities, you know, an alternative to hate as a social ideology, as a lived ideology, is something that we have to fight for. And it'll take a generation, if not longer, to win that battle. And while we fight that, we need to fight the electoral battle to get the spaces to fight.
I want to add and respond to a few things. One is that I fully agree with Dave when he said that, you know, the economic implications of what has happened in India also had a major reason for, you know, why they were reduced to these numbers. But I want to reiterate that what Harsh spoke about, the idea of India, that is very much in the hearts of people, and that was one of the major reasons of their defeat. I do not agree that people did not fight for the saving of the constitution. I think the major chunk of seats that we got from Uttar Pradesh, the reason was that the Dalit voters shifted to the India Alliance and they shifted only to safeguard the constitution. I have personally attended many public meetings in Delhi called by the Dalits, and for the first time openly calling to vote for the India Alliance and not for the party for whom they have always voted, that is the BSP. And shifting the vote from BSP to India Alliance was, I think, a major reason of why we were able to get whatever seats the India Alliance got. That is one thing. Second thing, I want to come to what Harsh was talking about, the RSS. Everything, of course, whatever Harsh has said is absolutely right. But what is also important to understand for the other countries, that RSS is not growing and controlling the government and the minds of the people only in India. RSS is growing on your soils. Hatred is being sown and spreading on your soils. And through the diaspora, through various institutions that exist in US, in UK, in Australia, in South Africa, there could be any kind of semi-religious organizations. So it's very important to study them and see what is happening in their own countries. And if they study and control what is happening there, because a lot of money is inflowing from there to support hate in India. If that is controlled in US and UK, it will have implications in India also. And last thing I wanted to say that, yes, it is very important to have much bigger, show of strength on the streets. But civil society is absolutely crumpled and strangulated financially. I mean, I can speak for our small organization, which was present in many, many states. And we were extremely active in doing major campaigns across India. A lot of things are not possible now only because there are no resources available. And it is not only, Anhad, a small organization. There are 30,000 or whatever number, 25,000 other organizations who have been totally strangulated, who were working with people. Also, nobody has studied the kind of job loss that has happened in the development sector and how it has affected the most marginalized communities, whether it is Muslims, Adivasis, tribals, Dalits, and other poor and women. So these are some of the things which we need to look at.
I just wanted to add to what Shabnam was saying, that how do we create an alternative to the RSS ideology or to the BJP is a question which the India Alliance, which has now been formed all over, a hope that there is an emerging leadership which is not like earlier totally family-based, but it will be a larger alliance of opposition parties, which will be secular, which will be above caste, which will be consisting of all the voices of the intellectuals, the NGOs, the marginalized. We need to create that kind of a vision for the people of India, a hope, a flag under which they can all come together. Because all these years against the BJP, you had the BJP as this umbrella organization of a majority party. And then we had these splinters of various opposition parties which were trying to, hobble together. And at the, one file being opened, they would defect to the BJP. This kind of opposition is of no use to the Indian people, because the Indian people don't want to jump into the fire from the pan. The people are ready. You give a good alternative which is honest, non-corrupt, secular, ready for a fight on the streets, the Indian people will support you. And this has shown in this election that we will vote bravely, courageously against, everything, against all odds. But you put together an opposition party which has the audacity to take power. So this, I think, is very important, that we need to create an alternative to the RSS ideology. At the same time, we must bring a vision and bring heroes for the Indian people who can take on somebody like Narendra Modi's oratory, the BJP's discipline, RSS's grassroot organizations. We need to build this. And once we have this together, I think we have a good fight.
Harsh, you raised the question of, would Modi act now as a wounded tiger, that there have been more signs of perhaps more repression? I wonder what others think in terms of that. Deb, did you have thoughts on that one? You're a journalist. What are you hearing from your journalist friends? Is it feeling harder to operate, more open? How is it feeling?
Yes. So one of the first things that the government did was, I think, the Delhi police filed a charge sheet against four journalists of Caravan magazine for something they did in 2020, which was obviously a fake charges. And apart from that, you know, like the main instrument of media control is money. And or that relationship between the government and the media barons is not going to change. So we'll continue to have what we in India call the Godi media, which is the laptop media. So these intimidations will continue, or the media control will continue. In fact, set of new laws are coming in which will make media control even easier. And I think the new Telegraph Act, I've forgotten the exact name of the law, which will force journalists to name their sources if the government demands to know. So all of these will continue. And so one thing I would like to add here on this continuing cycle of repression and what the result means for all of this is that maybe we haven't noticed one thing, is that Modi did, the BJP did lose 63 seats, but overall vote share, the BJP's overall vote share came down by only 0.7%. And this is because in a lot of other states where the BJP is not really a big force and it is not in power, its vote share increased in those states, while its vote share in states where it is a big player, they fell. So overall, its vote share didn't really change a lot. And also, Modi is very different from other politicians in the sense that this party is not just about winning the next election, or this party is about changing the nature of the Indian state. And a slight loss of seats and a drop of 0.7% of the vote will not change that program. So nothing is actually going to change. And again, there are a couple of other things that I want to point out, is that much has been made of Modi's loss of majority, but we tend to forget that Modi's party still has like 240 seats, right? That's a huge number when you compare it with the number of seats that the Congress held in the coalition that it ran in the decade before Modi. It was about 100 seats. But still, Manmohan Singh managed to make a lot of lasting policy changes that affected India. So in the same way, 240 seats may be less than absolute majority, but being the single largest party and the support that it has, it is not going to stop Modi from doing anything that he was doing before. And the second thing is that people, or we tend to often focus a lot on Modi, or for good reason. But there is also an aspect of competitive despotism which is playing out in India. So yes, Modi is weakened internally and the knives are out. And one of the first, and there is open rivalry within the party. But the fallout of that could be dangerous. The fallout of that could be people trying to outdo Modi. And so that in the end doesn't really help India, right? So Modi's weakening is not really a net plus for India. I will give an example. This is the time of a Hindu pilgrimage of a certain kind in mainly it's very popular in northern India. So young men, they take the holy water from one place to another, and it's a big deal. So recently, Modi's ministers have started saying things like, these Hindu pilgrims, they don't know which restaurant is run by Muslims, which restaurant is run by Hindu, and they end up eating at Muslim restaurants. This can't go on, this has to stop, etc. So the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, who is very popular with a section of the BJP supporters, who now think Modi is a softie, and because this guy makes Modi look good, actually, because he's a real hardliner, and he's himself a monk turned politician, so he's clothed in saffron and all of that. What the state government did was it suddenly issued a rule that said that every proprietor of every shop has to clearly write the name of the owner so that it's visible. So you have to basically tell whether you are a Hindu or a Muslim and or to declare so that ostensibly Hindu pilgrims don't end up eating at Muslim shops. Right. This is bringing back untouchability, basically. Yeah. But the fact that an elected state government, which swore by the constitution, was able to do this, and it, of course, did not get away with this. There were activists who took the matter to court, and the court had to step in and halt it. But the fact that it was done tells you that there is this element of competitive despotism going on. So a Modi's weakening is not, may not really be a good thing, because there might be it might make things even worse. That's my take.
If I can, I'm just adding this kind of sobering note that Deb has put in about the battles that lie ahead. On the one hand, I really share the optimism that the people of India have demonstrated that they stand up against the kind of politics that have been playing out. Yes, and that is our strength. The opposition parties have come together. That is also our strength. But just looking at the rising attacks and lynchings that have happened over since the elections, there's been a conspicuous silence on that question by the political leadership. The political courage to stand up with India's Muslim minorities, even the number of Muslims that secular parties were willing to put up as candidates, has hit its lowest at this time. Also for the economy, what is your alternative imagination for job creation, for instance, for fighting inequality? So I think that and lastly, that the repression is definitely going to grow. I see my own, just what we have been trying to battle over the last month and a half is sort of a further peaking or with the kind of repression that we've seen over recent years. And also, as Shabnam said, there's no money at all for civil society to battle. So it's going to be a very difficult period that lies ahead. But we still stand with the conviction that we, the people of India, which is the first words in our constitution, we, the people of India, will stand up in defense of the constitution in a very difficult battle that lies ahead.
I want to add something, because I don't think that despite everything, whatever is happening and the repression and everything, there is a lot which has changed, and there's a lot of hope. At least if we talk of the parliament, see what was happening in the parliament before these elections and what is happening now has changed drastically. The opposition is much more stronger. They are giving a very good fight inside the parliament. The popularity of the India Alliance leader Rahul Gandhi among the young people has spiraled. It has gone up like anything. So while the battle is very difficult, and there is no doubt that the repression has already started, but I think that we are in a much better position now to fight back than what we were before the general elections. There is a lot more hope, and I am very sure that with the state elections which are going to happen over the next few months, there would be quite a few states which would be taken away from the BJP, and that would again change the situation in the country, because if you have more states, then you will automatically get more representation in the upper house of the parliament over a period of time. So while the fight goes on, but it is not the end. And I don't think that Indian people are going to allow the right wing to take over the country as they had dreamed earlier.
I share Shabnam's optimism, but I share Deb's pessimism as well. I think we need to carry both.
I wish I could spend more time with Shabnam or to be more optimistic. But I hear what she's saying, but I feel that what is happening in the parliament is that, yes, the opposition is speaking more and making itself heard, but in form, there seems to be, things seem to be changing, but in substance, it isn't. I think that's my pessimistic view of the world.
Vinod, I think you're a fellow optimist along with Shabnam. Anything more you would like to add?
I would just say that all these efforts which we are doing even today at TODA, I think all these discussions are very important to crystallize our thoughts, bring all the people together, because we have to continue to create platforms where like-minded people continue to fight with hope, because we can't lose hope here, because on the ground zero, there is no other choice. The fight is on, and people are looking for leadership. People are looking for movements. People are looking for solutions for their day-to-day problems. And I think we have a large job to do, which we have to put our heads down for the next 5 years and continue to work with the people, surrounded by people, because that is our only protection, that the democratic movements will give us the space and the protection against repression from the government. So thank you very much for bringing us all together.
And that's an occasion then for me to say thank you very much for this very robust and frank conversation. It's clear from what all of you have said that, you know, you've won the battle, but the war remains to be won. I want to thank you for your realism and for your optimism and for your hopefulness. And on behalf of the TODA Peace Institute and my colleague Olivia, who's very much deeply involved in this program. I mean, I'd just like to say, you know, we stand in solidarity with you as you do what you need to do in order to ensure that the Constitution is respected, that political parties are able to operate as parties should operate, that the RSS is somewhat curtailed in its operations, and that your Muslim colleagues and brothers and sisters don't have to live in fear on a daily basis. So once again, thank you very much for all of your contributions to this excellent conversation.